Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, bonds. As you saw in an announcement I sent out this morning, we'll do the last quiz before the midterm on Wednesday. It'll be kind of a comprehensive affair just to make sure you've got a good feeling for what's going to be on the midterm. The way I do this seems to be successful in keeping the midterm scores a little bit better. Monday of next week is just a review day, and I will be telling you what I want you to know, what I think you should know. You write it down. That's your study guide to get you so that you can prepare for the midterm exam. Now, I usually do that. I tell you what I think you should know, and then I open it up for you to ask me questions. Well, is this going to be on there? If it's not, I'll say, no, I'm not going to ask that. And you can ask for explanations. I'll go through some of the previous quiz questions just to make sure that you know how to do the problems, know why the answer I put down as correct is correct, and make sure that you are prepared for that. Now, on Wednesday, we do the midterm exam. It's 75 minutes, and you are allowed a 4x6 note card front and back for that. You can't use your notes, but you've got to prepare a nice 6x4 note card. And then you can bring in a printed version of that formula sheet, the financial ratio analysis sheet. And on that, nothing on there, unless you want to just write a quick explain what this ratio means on there, I would allow for that. But no comprehensive notes and all that on there. And like I said, you have the 75 minutes. It's in the lockdown browser. So make absolutely sure that browser is working. If it's not for you, if you're having glitches on it, get to our office. We can figure out what it is and get you straightened up. Like I said in the announcement, the one thing we have noticed is that uninstalling and then reinstalling it seems to be the best way to shake out the problems that you're having. But there are a few that are something else. So make sure that you're ready for the midterm, because once we get to Wednesday, it's all there in Canvas in the lockdown browser. A look at the numbers. I won't take too much time on the numbers today, but there are some crucial points that I need to make, and they might be a little uncomfortable about what the numbers are telling us. But if you look over here on the other side of the world, the Nikkei dropped. That's in the Tokyo Exchange. The Nikkei 225 dropped 1.12%. That was on significant confusion about what these tariffs. Late last week, the Supreme Court ruled that the tariffs that had been imposed by the White House were unconstitutional. That suddenly let relief all over the world. But then immediately, the White House announced that it was going to use something other than the law it first invoked to put a global 15% tariff on everything coming from overseas, which was just shook the markets up again. There was relief, and then there was not relief. And so Tokyo took a large part of that shockwave. And as you can see, when the Nikkei opened last night, it just dropped. And then from there, it didn't do much of anything because the information the bad information came through, it got put into the prices, and then from there was no good news, no bad news, so it just floated there, as you can see in that spark chart right there, if you can see it. That's the effect that information caused it to drop on the opening bell to reflect the bad news, and then from there, it just drifted. Now, on the other hand, you see Hang Seng is doing well. And there's a good reason for that, because as we marginalize ourselves and take ourselves off the world stage, the other players who are vast, massive industrial economies get open up new markets, and they will sell from their country, and we essentially just handed them the global trade, the global markets. That's all we did. And so that vast ocean of a country with its insanely well-developed industrial and manufacturing base for is the winner. And you see it happening in the stock markets, in the stock market there. Now, when we get to the sun rising in Europe, it was kind of what's going on. Like, for example, the CAC 40. On the Paris Exchange, 40 stocks on this Paris Exchange, just kind of floated up and down, trying to figure out what's coming, what's next. Okay, we were under this tariff regime, it let go, but there, here it is coming back again. And so they just kind of went up and down, not very significantly. It was down about 0.25%. Now, interestingly, you see that that was about the same story with the London Exchange, with the FTSE 100, just kind of drifting up and down, trying to figure out what comes next. Is this good? Because we've got the rest of the world is going to be coming to us for their goods and services, or is it bad because the stuff that we used to sell in the United States is going to cost more there, so no one's going to buy, or fewer people will buy it? It's a hard thing for a lot of countries to figure out what's going on and what the consequences are. Investors are sort of in a quandary. However, you come look at the Dow, just it's diving down 1.70%. That's a significant bad day. It's not certainly not a black swan, but it's certainly marking the great deal of not confusion, but concern that we are just doing one thing after another that is going to hurt our economy. And the S&P 500 was down 1.21%. The NASDAQ was floating around, 1.44%. So these are all very bearish numbers reflecting what has happened over the last 72 hours from Thursday through this morning. And anything that creates that kind of risk, that kind of adverse impact, is just going to cause the markets to get very defensive. And gold, if you will see, it had taken a dive some weeks back, and I down into the $4,700 an ounce range. But as I told you, that wasn't going to be the end of the story. It would come back, and here it is. Gold is moving upward aggressively. It's about to cross over the last high that it had. I think that was like 6 weeks ago. It was, but now it's coming right back up into that range where we know very well that that is a whole pile of investors who are getting the hell out of financial investments and buying into hard metal. And in fact, just to give you a personal note on this, having the courage of convictions, I took a position in gold over a couple of weeks ago, and that position has doubled in that time since I took it. And so it's almost a no-brainer. We are going into a recession. The Treasury Secretary of the United States, he took a very bold move, risking anger from the president. He said, get ready for a very hard ride. We're going to go downward. And so he said it. And so sure enough, he was telling the truth about that. Now, crude oil has already passed the 65-70 little pairing that I told you about. Average on crude is now 66.25. The average on the light sweet is more than $71. oil prices are beginning to increase. The slowing of demand is more than offset by the reduction in supply of oil in the reserves on the high seas and at the refineries. You'll probably see gasoline prices move upward, not dramatically now, but maybe up, making it back to $3 a gallon in the next few weeks. We'll see about that. Now, a quick look at the sector map. Can't see. There we go. Sector map. There you go. This is more evidence of that rotation that I told you about. The rotation of the heavy investors out of the risky high beta stocks and into the more the safer world of consumer oriented companies and that kind of stuff. So, and you see it here, technology sector, the rotation is beginning to be noticeable at this point. When I told you about it last week, you wouldn't have seen it in the sector map, but it now it's picked up enough momentum that we are going to see more of that coming along in the days ahead. Just to take you on a little trip around, let me show you two companies. I won't do any holding period returns. I just want to show you a couple of companies. Good news companies and bad news companies. Now, the first is a good news company that not only has earnings that are better than expected, but also is introducing a new item that has a favorable, has gotten favorable thumbs up from analysts in the fast food industry. This is McDonald's. And as you can see, McDonald's is up quite a bit, up 1.80%, which is a good, strong up day. And remember, this is a bear day, and McDonald's came through. You see the spike there? Well, that would be earnings. And they were above what we expected them to be. And so we're going to we're going to see a company. Notice it has a nice low beta. It has a decent dividend. The beta is 0.53. The dividend yield is 2.26%. It's making money. Geez, look at that. Earnings per share is $11.95, almost $12 a share. That's a company you just can't beat, those kinds of numbers. Those are awesome numbers. And so what that means is that the market is going to reward a company like that. Even in a day that was a bear day, a good company with strong earnings, a long history, a relatively tame, very tame beta, it's going to do well. And even in a bad times like we're going to be having. Now, contrast that with another company in the same industry, Wendy's. Wendy's is getting slaughtered today, down a whopping 3.5% just in the day. And it's just a catastrophe for Wendy's. It was one of those companies like McDonald's. It was part of the American landscape. It had a good marketing shtick for many, many years with Wendy herself, the owner's daughter, being the lovable icon of the company. And now where are they? They've dropped to a point where they're falling toward penny stock territory. Certainly they're not a penny stock, but let me show you something about it. Look at the 1 year. It's a death watch. They're just sliding. And you look at this and you see a company that just can't do anything right as far as the market is concerned. It just keeps sliding downward and further and further. No, this isn't a buy waiting to happen. This is a funeral waiting to be started on a company like this. Are they going to go bankrupt? Absolutely not. Are they going to be a great investment, buy while it's cheap? I wouldn't recommend it. They haven't shown any signs of life in at least a year. And so you look at a company like this, it's got a low beta, and that dividend is to die for. That's an incredibly good dividend, 6.92%. they're paying a dividend to keep their shareholders happy in the face of losing money on the investment in the stock itself. So there you are. And these kinds of companies, and what I'm doing here in a way is I'm giving you that way of thinking that you are persistently looking for a reason to not like an investment. But when you see one that just can't stop being a winner, like a McDonald's, that's when you take your cynicism, your bearish part of your mind, and you put that aside and say, yeah, this is good. This is a strong company. And then you see Wendy's, and all of that bearish sentiment that you should have comes right out and says, it's not for me. This is a loser, and I'm watching it walk down the pathway to its grave. So with that out of the way, let me take you on the journey of bonds. And let me explain. There is part of chapter 8 that's terminology, definitions. Some of it's actually a little bit interesting, things you never knew before. But then there's a math part too. And fortunately for you, I have a spreadsheet for that. So that some of that math back in the day, it would take you maybe 30 minutes to do one problem. But Excel is really good at bond math. And there are actually some calculators like the TI 83 plus 84 that can do bond math. It's a little cumbersome, but it's not bad. However, for the purposes of the exam, I will ask you only about the terminology and concepts. I will not have you do any math. We'll get back to it. I'll show it to you on Wednesday. I'll show you how to do it. But at the same time, I'm not going to beat you up with any of that math on the midterm exam or on the quiz for that matter, obviously. But it will be on the quizzes after this, after the spring break, and it will be on the final exam. But for now, just enjoy this lecture because I could ask you questions about this on the midterm. Now, while I'm getting this set up, why don't you do your attendance radar so that that's all done and I can get started here. The title of this, as I said, is Bonds. If a company needs a lot of money in a quick fashion, you, sir, are the owner of, you're the CEO of a company, and you need $50 million. There are two basic ways that you could raise that quickly. Obviously, over a long period of time, you should be earning revenue, you know, making money the old-fashioned way. But in a more critical environment, you could sell stock in your corporation. That would mean that you were selling ownership interest, watering down the current shareholders, putting yourself as a CEO at risk of new shareholders wanting to kick you out, and all that. That's what we call equity. Common stock, preferred stock, those kinds of things, equity. The other way you could raise money quickly is by borrowing it. And in other words, debt. You could issue debt. Now, debt is in some ways good because it's cheaper than equity. Debt has the, but that's the problem. Debt has the prior claim to the cash flows. If you look at an income statement, all of these obligations, selling, general and administrative expenses, interest expense, those are all there before the profit line. The profit or the free cash flow is what belongs to the owners. That means that the debt holders have to be satisfied the debt holders have the prior claim to the cash flows of a company. They have to be satisfied with the obligations that are due at any given time before the shareholders can take their residual claim. That residual claim can come with the company paying some dividends to the shareholders, or the company could put the money, the profits, back into the corporation to grow it, and we would hope increase the stock price. But that's all after debt holders have been made happy in a timely manner. That prior claim is one of the reasons that debt is cheaper than equity. Debt is cheaper than equity. For one, like I said, they're in a safer position than the stockholders are. Because if you, sir, don't pay me my interest check, I will turn you off. One day afterwards, I will be there to shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your parents wear furries. There's nothing wrong with that, okay? The point I'm trying to make here is that don't mess with the shareholders. They will send you essentially to annihilation, nothing. Now, if I do not give the shareholders a dividend, or if I don't make the stock price go up, the shareholders have one thing they can do. They can cry. They can come to the shareholders meeting and bitch at me as a CEO, whatever, but they can't do what the debt holders can. So you are going to make, as if I'm your lender, you're going to make me happy before you're going to make your shareholders happy. And of course, the shareholders might say, well, you better give us a dividend or I'm going to sue you. Really? You're an owner of the company. You're suing yourself. Isn't that a brilliant move? You see how they're in a boxed position? Now, they can make huge amounts of money. Stock price goes up, big dividends. But you see, they can do that only if you make me happy first as the investor, as the lender. The thing about this also is I need to make a mention. One other reason debt is cheaper than equity is because you get to write the interest as an expense before you calculate taxes. Dividends, you pay that out of after-tax income. But the debt, you actually pay only a fraction of what the actual interest rate is, because some of that interest expense is knocking off what you're getting taxed from your operating income. Okay, so a couple of parts to this I need to bring up. There are different ways to divide bill up, debt up, but one that is important to start with is the time to maturity and what that has to do with the debt instrument I'm talking about. A bill is due within a year. I hear people say, well, I got a bill in the mail. Well, no, you didn't, because actually you were the issuer of the bill, like your electric bill. You issued a bill to the electric company. They lent you electricity for a specific amount of time, and then they send you a reminder that you must retire that debt instrument that you issued. It happened day by day. You were building up a debt to the electric company. And it's short term because at the end of a certain period, a month, you have to satisfy that debt, retire it, and then they revolve it and you move on to the next month. That's the technical way we think about bills. They are ours. We're issuing debt in to utility company, the electric company, the water and sewerage, to the trash company, trash hauling company. All of those are bills that we are issuing. They're not issuing them to us. We're issuing them. Now, this one is a little bit dicier. A note. I think even 10 years ago, I would have put it's 1 year to 7 years. But then it has become very popular, it seems, in recent years to go as far as 15 years. I got a wake-up call on this when it's been maybe 5-7 years, Netflix issued a massive amount of paper, 15-year paper, Netflix did. And it was junk. It was junk bonds. And I'll talk about those a little later. But and the news, financial news, and even Netflix itself were saying, we issued 15-year notes. And I thought, 15 years, that would really be more in the territory of bonds. Since then, I've seen other issues that had 15 years, 10 years, and all that being called notes. So, okay, 1 to 15 years. Now, the bond is definitely the long stuff. It's not due for a long, 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 long time. And of course, this is generically we say bond, regardless of what kind of debt it is. Let me do something right here. I need to make a distinction that will, in a way, affect you, because more and more in your lives, you're coming into that professional time in your life, and you're going to see emerging a life and a world that are different from your personal life, your home life, your household life, your private life. That is your corporate existence. You're part in this vast machinery of global commerce. And you'll see some interesting distinctions start to emerge that you wouldn't have even thought of before. There's one where I put in consumer debt versus corporate government debt. When you issue a long term, a bond or a note, you borrow for a car on a 6-year note. It's a note because it's 6 years. So that is you're issuing. You are the borrower. That means you are issuing paper. And an investor, probably a bank, is going to buy your paper. Buying the paper is exactly the same as lending the money. They mean the same thing. The investor buys your note. Or you get a house. You issue a bond. It's a special kind of bond called a mortgage bond. We'll talk about that in a little while. However, corporations and the government are obviously borrowing money too. There's a fundamental distinction. The payment you have, we calculated those loan payments. You'll have one of those on the midterm exam and one on the final too and a quiz. That payment actually does two things. Part of it goes to interest, and part of it goes to principal. PAL. And you saw that amortization table. You probably, I don't know, you might have seen it in accounting too, but you can put in those numbers into my Excel sheet and you can see how much is going to interest, how much is going to principal through the life of the loan. Now, the part that goes to interest is called servicing the debt. The part that goes to principal is called amortizing the debt. So your payments, both service and amortize, with debt that is issued by corporations or by the government, all you ever pay during the life of the loan is interest. You just service the debt. Then at the end, you pay one last interest payment. And at the end, you pay all of what you borrowed. In other words, your payments along the way are holding the principal level at the amount you borrowed. And then at the end, you make that payment to kill off the debt. Now, lenders are not stupid. They're going to expect that you are putting money aside all along the way, so that way before the debt is actually due, you have the money to do that retirement of the principal and kill the debt. Those are, by the way, called sinking funds. There are a couple of different things. One of the most common, or at least the most well-known, is a sinking fund. In other words, you borrowed $50 million from me. So every year, and you borrowed it for 30 years. So just making it simple, I am going to expect you to put $2 million into a special sinking fund account so that well before the 30 years is done, you've got the money to pay me off, to take care of me as the lender. You're not getting off with doing this, but definitely it's different from consumer debt. And let me make what was I thinking? I got so many things going through my head right now. Oh, the interest payments, they're called coupons. The coupon rate on the debt is, let's say in the $50 million, it's 8% debt. The coupon is 8%. That means that every year to me, you pay me 8% of the $50 million, $400,000. Now, in a U.S. debt, you pay that in two installments, 6 months apart. So in other words, every 6 months, I, as your lender, get a check for $200,000. Your book starts out saying they're annual, and then later they say, okay, they're really semi-annual. It really doesn't matter. When you use Excel, you can put it whichever way you want. It's just a zero or a one for annual, semi-annual versus annual coupon payments. So you don't need to sweat that at all when you do the calculation. But in the United States, it's typically semi-annual. The 8% is divided into two semi-annual payments. Interestingly, in Europe, you'll see a lot of paper that is annual coupons, not semi-annual. And I actually didn't know it was that common until I got quite involved in that arena of international funds. But anyway, that is sort of the breakdown. Now, the machinery of borrowing the money itself. And you may have already done this in the personal consumer finance, or you will do it sometime in the near future. You're going to go in and buy a car, new car, and you're going to go be taken into this office with someone who is their loan officer. He may be a representative of the bank, he may be financing as an agent of the bank, something like that. But he'll have all this paperwork and he'll be explaining it to you because the law requires it to give you very detailed understanding of what you're doing. And then he will hand you the paperwork, you'll sign it. And then he'll come back across the table and he'll sign it. That is you issuing the debt instrument, in this case a note, and he, as a representative of a financial institution, is the investor, the buyer of that paper. So in other words, you are actually the creator of the paper, the writer, the issuer, the seller, and the sale price is agreed upon, that will be how much they lend you to have you buy the car. So it's kind of different from how you think about it in normal language. You would not think of yourself borrowing the money that you're actually the writer of the instrument. You are actually the seller of a piece of paper that will turn into a nice car for you. That's not the way people think about it, but that's technically the way it is. So the thing, though, is that that process also happens in corporate debt, too. It's a much longer, it's a grueling process, because an investment banking syndicate will, you needed the $50 million. I'm the IB, the investment banker. I will get a syndicate of other banks to get involved in this, so we put together the $50 million, and none of us is exposed to the entire amount, distributing the risk, as it were. And then what we'll do is we'll sit down with your representatives, the investment bank representing its investors, and you and a team of lawyers representing your companies, sellers of debt. We'll figure out all of these pieces, and we'll put that into this big document called an indenture agreement. I had been teaching this course, a course of like this, at the time for probably about 20, 25 years. I'd been a financial consultant, I'd run my own companies, and I had actually never seen the real indenture agreement. It's like a loan agreement, except it's got pages and pages of wherefores, herewiths, and all of that. Obviously, and I'd never seen one, and I had a chance to, real close friend of mine in New York City worked at an IB, and, well, it was a brokerage house, an IB, and I said, when I went, called him to tell him I was coming to town, he said, and I said, do you happen to have an indenture agreement I could see? And Marty said something like, you never seen one? I swear I've never seen one. So he had one on his desk when I got to his office, when I got into New York City. The thing was this thick. It was just like a book of, it starts off with, you know, who's the borrower? Who's the lender? What's the interest rate, the coupon rate? And, the list of the address and all this kind of stuff. And all of this came the covenants. These are all of the particulars, as it were, the specifics, and everything is covered. One of the things, interestingly enough, very early in the document, you see the naming of the bond trustee. Now, that is a person or a law firm that oversees the interests of the bond holders, the lenders, on the board of directors of the corporation. They are that bond trustee is the naysayer. A company might decide, well, we want to issue a nice big dividend, make our shareholders happy. The bond trustee says, no, you're not. Absolutely not. You must make sure that we get paid our interest payments. You don't go buying gifts to make your shareholders love you. You do only what is necessary for the shareholders, and you protect your free cash flow so that we can get our interest checks and then get our final, finish off the loan. The company said, well, we want to take on this wild project, really risky, but man, this could pay off big time. No, that project could pay off big time for your shareholders. It does nothing for the bondholders, nothing at all. We are going to get the same amount of money every 6 months for the next 30 years. We don't care if your stock price goes to the moon. What we care about is, do you have enough money to pay us? So they, that bond trustee, can put an iron fist down on anything that could risk the cash flow that is the prior claim of the debt holders, of the bond holders. So that's one of those things you see in there. It's kind of, it was kind of glaring because it was the first time I'd actually seen it in the legalese of the indenture agreement. And there are a lot of other things in there too. And I'll tell you about some of those here in just a minute. But you can have these provisions. One I should mention real quick before I forget it, because sometimes I do, is there are two kinds of debt instruments. There's mortgage debt, and there are debentures. Now, a mortgage provision means that there is some collateral, physical, probably collateral, that is attached so that if you don't pay me, I take you to bankruptcy court and I say that factory, that belongs to me because it's in the indenture agreement. I get to liquidate that, or that fleet of trucks, or that laboratory, or something like that. That ship. In other words, there's something attached. Now, that's why they call home loans mortgages. Is they're actually mortgage loans. They're mortgage loans because the house is collateral. A car loan is always, almost always, a mortgage note because the car is attached. If you don't pay your payments, they repo the car. That is as opposed to a debenture that is uncollateralized. They are riskier, of course, obviously, because you know, you go bankrupt, they don't have anything to attach and take away from you. Credit cards are a classic debenture. Companies issue debentures too. I mean, they are riskier, so they obviously carry a higher coupon than mortgages, mortgage bonds of the same quality and amount. But you know, they're out there, and both kinds are out there. But again, keep in mind that of course a mortgage bond would have a lower default premium. Remember when I did that? Because there's something that the debt holders can take back if you don't pay. Debentures are just out there waiting for a bankruptcy to happen. I need to, before I forget, another thing. There's actually a third kind of, I showed you the consumer and corporate. Payment has interest and principal versus corporate that has just interest paid along the way. There's actually a third animal, and it's, we think of it most of the time with corporations or the government. It's very short term, but there is a version of it that happens with normal consumers, households. And it's very short term. And the kind that happens with normal people is wickedly awful, but it's very, very common. And it's a huge source of profit for these companies that do these kinds of short term loans. The type of debt I'm talking about here is called discount paper. It works like this. I need, let's say, $10,000. Well, what you'll do, but you'll say, okay, you're going to pay me back $10,000, and you're going to pay it back to me in what, 60 days? Yeah. Okay, well, what I'll do is I will lend you $9,920. And then in 60 days, you pay me back $10,000. You see why we call it discount paper? You make your money off the difference between what you lend and what you get back. Now, this is very popular in corporate, big, huge corporate America. They'll issue commercial paper for 30 days or 120 days. And we're going to pay you back $10 million. And then there's kind of a bidding process, and someone says, okay, I will lend you 9,999,999. $90,000 to get $10 million back in 60 days or whatever. That's, see, it's discounted to its par value, discounted to par. And our government does those too with a paper that is a year or less. They're called T-bills, treasury bills. And I want to show you one right now. I will not ask you to recapitulate this, but what's going on the exam for next week. But what I will do is show you something that is a fundamental principle of finance. It's an arithmetic phenomenon, but it has huge implications in the entire world of finance. It works like this. When our government wants to borrow money, it uses an auction system. Now it's all electronic, but in the past, they would essentially put debt instruments on huge tables, and then investors would come up and buy some of it. Buying it meant they were lending the government money, and the proof that they had lent it was the paper. And with treasury bills, it would work like this. We'll go with a one-year T-bill, treasury bill. Now, the way I'll be doing this, of course, is not how it is actually done now, which is where there is no table with auction paper on it. It's all electronic. But here's how it works. The T-bill will have a price. That price is actually being driven by supply and demand dynamics. There are investors who will demand the paper. They will buy the paper. And then the government itself is supplying the paper. And all that happens is something like this. There will be a price at which a T-bill, a one-year T-bill, would sell. And it will go up and down based upon the demand at the time. Now, there is the payoff. We call that the face value. The future value. It is always, unless I say differently, for any debt, $1,000. We use 1,000 as sort of our benchmark and then scale it by the actual amount of the debt. But you don't need to be told that, it will always be 1,000. In fact, in my spreadsheets, I have that 1,000 locked so you can't try to change it. So you will have that chance. But now, what will happen? Let's say that you buy one of those T-bills for $975. Okay, so in 1 year, you're going to get $1,000. You will get $1,000. You bought it for $975, so your dollar interest is going to be $25. Because you invested this much, you got that much, $25. Okay, so then what we can do is calculate the yield. A one-year yield, because the one-year instruments, it's a perfect calculation for a year. You got $25 on an investment of $975. I almost caught myself doing it. Now, the temptation is to put $1,000 down there. That's not what you invested. You invested $975. That's all you did. You invested $975. Okay, if I calculate that and make it a percent, that's 2.56%. That's what you made off the bond. That was your investment. That's discount paper. Notice that discount paper, there's an interest rate that is implied by the difference between the price and the face value. We don't trade in interest rates in stock markets, bond markets, kind of in futures markets we do, but we trade in prices. The prices are telling us through the arithmetic what the interest rate was. Now, suppose that after a year you get your money and you say, well, that was fun. I'll go do that again. So you go to the auction again, and this time there are hardly any buyers. So the price sinks down so that this time you can get one for $950. You're still going to get $1,000 at the end. That's the agreement. So this time you made $50. So let's calculate the yield again. You made $50, this time on an investment of only $950. So your interest rate this time is 5.26%. And right there you see an example of one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. What do you notice about the price versus the yield? When the price goes down, the yield goes where? That is one of the most fundamental principles ever. It's not an opinion, it's not a theory, it's just arithmetic. Prices of financial instruments are inversely related to their yields by arithmetic. It's not something we could change, it's just the arithmetic. As prices of financial instruments fall, their yields rise. As prices rise, the yields fall. And this is a simple one, but the same arithmetic applies to any debt instrument. And in fact, it applies to stock prices too. As the price of a stock goes down, the expected yield you are going to get, you expect to get, should go up because of the same arithmetic process here. So that's, and like I said, I will ask you for the general principle because it's important for the rest of the course to understand this dynamic relationship that is just a lockstep relationship between prices and yields of financial instruments of any kind. Now, let me do something here. Kind of cleaning this up a little bit. Bonds come in all kinds of different types. And by the way, I say bond, and by that that's sort of a generic label for any debt instrument, bill, note, or bond. But bonds can come in all kinds of different oddballs. There was mortgage versus debenture. But you also have some other animals out there. And really, you have to be careful about which one you're talking about. One thing is a callable bond. Now, this one you may very well see in your lives, in your personal lives, because they are in personal loans as well as corporate loans. A callable bond is one where I, as the lender, could call the whole debt in early. All at once, I could make you pay that whole $50 million, not in 30 years, but maybe in 7 years or 12 years. I could call it in. Now, where you'll see this is that this provision, this covenant, is in every home mortgage. You see, let's say that you don't make your payments for 2 months. I, as a lender, will invoke what is called an acceleration clause. I will send you a letter that the entire balance of your loan is due in 30 days. And you have that, and you'll say, wait, I can get the payments together, I can get them together in about a week and a half, I swear, doesn't matter. I've already called the loan. And so that acceleration clause means that if you don't pay me the entire amount that's due, in 30 days, I will have the sheriff's deputies come and sweep your car, all your stuff out to the curb, just like that. It's over. That is, and there's a corporate equivalent of that too. There's a twist on it called the puttable. And some put this with two T's, and I put it with one T. You can put the loan. you, as the borrower, could put the loan back to me as your lender. You could say, I am going to pay you off the whole $50 million next month. I say, whoa, why are you doing that? And you'd say, well, it's obvious. You made me this loan when interest rates were 8%. Now they're 6%, so I'm going to kill the loan and borrow the money at 6%. You follow it? That in consumer finance is called refinancing. After a certain period of time, you can actually pay your mortgage off to get a lower rate. Essentially, borrow the money, you have a 6% home mortgage loan. You can see that interest rates on mortgages have gone to 4.5%. You can say, okay, I want to borrow at 4.5% enough money to pay off the 6% loan. That's a refinancing. And of course, I am, as a banker, that pisses me off because I was planning to get 6% from you for a 30-year mortgage, and you pull the rug out from under me when interest rates fall. So yeah, those are there. There are also convertible loans. Now, these can work either way. A convertible loan is when the loan's face principal is converted into stock. So, I lent you $20 million, but now the stock price is going through the roof. I'd say, oh, heck, I am going to convert my loan that I have to you into stock in your company. If that provision is in there, of course, I want to get in on the action. Now, not every loan, a bond, has this. It's a special. Now, the other side of that is if you can convert my debt into stock. Suppose that you're in real trouble financially. You can't make the interest payment to me. Your stock price is going to through the toilet. You could force me to become a shareholder. Instead of having a debt instrument and I can put you into bankruptcy, you turn me into a stockholder, being one of the owners of the basket case of a company. That would be a conversion the other way. Okay, now, last thing. Different, you think of a stock, a bond, okay, you borrow the money, then you pay it back in dollars. But there are bonds that don't pay back in dollars. They don't pay the interest. They don't pay the principal back in dollars. There are, for example, there are commodity bonds, the most famous of which are gold bonds, where the principal is paid off, the face value is paid off in gold or some other metal instead of dollars. We had a bad experience with that after World War II. Europe was just completely leveled to the ground. I mean, it was just the cities were like just piles of rubble. A good movie that gave a great depiction of this was Museum Men some years back. And of course, we wanted Europe on our side. We didn't want the Soviets to come in there to the rescue. So what we did is we said, we will pay for the rebuilding of Europe. We'll pay it. So how did we pay it? We borrowed the money. We issued gold bonds. They paid off in gold from Fort Knox, literally gold from Fort Knox. And of course, it worked. We got all the money we needed to make Europe look like it had before the war, modernize it and all that. The hilarious part about it was, perhaps not so hilarious as it is infuriating, was that the lenders, the buyers of those gold bonds, many of those were actually old European families who lent us the money to rebuild their country, and then we had to give them gold out of Fort Knox in exchange for it. And it would just rankled us because, you know, we're rebuilding your country, for heaven's sakes, and what are we doing? We're sending you gold for the privilege of having you lent us the money to do this. Well, there you go. Now, there are, of course, other commodity bonds, too. I've seen commodity bonds that are, I saw one that was in grain. where the payoff was in actual wheat and barley and things like that. That was some time ago. Now, another level on these are what are called foreign bonds. I saw one of these kind of up close. A foreign bond is a bond that pays off in another currency. The coupon payments and the principal are paid off in another country's currency. One example would be a company in the United States that wants to do DFI, direct financial investment, in, let's say, Europe. What it might do is actually issue the bonds and pay in euros, pay the interest payments, pay the face value back in euros. And that there's quite a bit of sense to that. Think about it this way. If I get the money back in dollars, then the exchange rate of euros to dollars matters all kinds of ways. You get what's called exchange rate risk. Right now, the dollar is plummeting against euros and all that kind of stuff. And other times, it's soaring. But yeah, so you do it in the country, in another country's currency. And think about it this way. A multinational company based here in the United States, it borrows the money in euros. It operates in euros over there, its business that it's doing with the borrowings. And then it makes its money in euros. Then that means that it never has to repatriate that money to the United States. It borrowed in euros, it makes its money in euros, it pays off the debt it incurred in euros. And so it essentially is no exchange rate risk. And in fact, as far as taxation goes, that money really isn't being repatriated ever to the United States. The revenue minus the operating costs, minus the interest expense, it's in euros and it stays in Europe, in European banks, and you make more investments in euros because that's what you're earning is euros. I saw a very amazing example of this. I've taught for years in Central America in the summers. And one summer, it's probably been maybe about 6-8 years ago, the country I was teaching in, the Republic of Panama, and they needed billions of dollars. They wanted to build a truly modern international airport because they're like the crossroads of the world there. And the Tucumán Airport, they upgraded. It's amazing now. It's a pain in the butt to try to walk from one end to the other. But they also wanted money to rehabilitate all of these ancient cities, you know, from the colonial period that were just in ruins. As a matter of fact, one was in such bad ruins that one of those monster movies was made in the city because the buildings were already torn down, so it looked like the monster had done it. But anyway, they issued two bonds that constituted, I keep thinking it was about $2 billion. They denominated the bonds not in the currency of Panama, the Balboa. They denominated them in American dollars. And what happened, it was like within 5 minutes of the opening to buy the bonds, the two were subscribed completely. They were just bought. By whom? By the Chinese. They just whipped out a check for those $1 billion or so and said, here, we're buying your bonds. And where did they get that kind of dollars? Well, obviously, it's because when Chinese send us goods to buy here in the United States, at the same time as they are importing goods to us, we are exporting American dollars to the People's Bank of China. So the foreign reserve of the People's Bank of China is on the order, I don't know what it is now, it's on the order of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. So they had plenty of dollars just to literally write a check to buy those two bonds that Panama had issued. And so that was a classic example of a foreign bond. Panama, the currency is Balboa. but the bonds were issued and would pay in American dollars. Gives you an interesting perspective on how complex the interrelationships are among countries and how trade deficits have everything to do with other countries importing, not just buying their bonds, but through that, creating vast influence in other countries. Panama is now essentially a protectorate of kind of the United States, but also of China, of the Arabs, of the Russians, because these countries flow funds in, and Panama figured out, you make them in dollars, then you'll bring all of the dollar boys to the schoolyard for the milkshakes. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.